Well, I think we're going to win the award for the most number of co-authors in this session. So I want to highlight all the... Actually, you can imagine the challenge. We did this all via phone conference establishing this presentation, and you can imagine the challenge of herding this many cats in the same direction. But the states we... Harry, I think this was your decision that Maryland was an honorary Southeastern member during all this. And we've got some great folks here out of the ARS lab in Beltsville. We've got a herd of people here from NC State that have been participating in this over time. Georgia here, Albert Culbreth, and Emily Cantonwine, and of course Harry as well, who's to blame for all of this. Kentucky, here more North Carolina, oh, more Georgia, Carol Johnson. And also the other honorary thing is that peanuts is a grain crop for the purpose of this presentation because, because there was good experience in peanuts by God and we weren't going to skip over it, so... Okay, first thing, I don't want to oversell the size of this industry, so in the Southeast right now. We are very rapidly growing. If you look at the number of acres that are in transition to organic, you know, in many cases here in North Carolina, we have as many in transition in 2007 as we had an actual production. So it is growing very rapidly, but it's still a very narrow slice of the total agricultural sector right now. Why is it growing so quickly? The economics on it look great. So here's a slide out of the Teasdale group there in Beltsville. And the economics on the organic rotations that they have in their systems experiment look very favorable compared to all the conventional rotations that they have. And I hear the exact same thing from our growers in North Carolina. So most of the growers in North Carolina, and we heard this from around the region, and it varies, it sounds like, from the story in the Midwest, where most of the growers we have are split operations. So they may have 1,000 acres of conventional grains, and then they're going to have several hundred acres of organic grains. And the farmers tell us as well that they're getting much higher returns on a per acre basis off of that organic acreage than they are off of the conventional acreage. So what are the major issues that we deal with? What are the challenges in the Southeast for organic grain production? Certainly weeds on the grower surveys come up as one of the number one concerns across the region. And again, the Beltsville lab has some excellent data coming out of that systems experiment documenting that as well, that the loss due to weeds can be a substantial part of the challenge that we face. So what are the tactics that we employ in the region to try to combat that problem? Certainly rotation can be a core part of that, and I think we'll have some excellent data coming out of that Beltsville lab again showing the impact that rotation can have on weeds. Parts of the Southeast, though, we have a real struggle with rotation. I know in North Carolina we have most of my organic grain production is along the coastal area, cannot make decent hay out there. Animals haven't been a part of their system out there for a very long time now. And it's very easy to get hemmed in to where corn, soybeans, and wheat is really the only things that you have at your disposal. And you can rotate as long as you want between those three crops without really having any impact on the weeds. Cover crops, certainly, and we've heard a lot at this meeting here in California about the role cover crops can play. Population, basic agronomic traits, we can actually tweak a lot of that off of standard recommendations to try to achieve better weed control. Even just cultivar selection, which Heather mentioned as well, and the organic context really needs to be rethought. And then mechanical control. You know, in weed science, we often like to talk about the many little hammers that help to control weeds. And so these are really a lot of little tactics that add up to try to get us a decent weed control. And then we have one big weed control mechanism at the end, a big hammer out there to try to finish off the task. Okay, so this is, you know, there's actually very few data sets, and this is a nice one coming out of that the Beltsville lab published here, looking at the effect of rotation length here on the weed seed banks. And we can see this is corn, soybean, wheat, and hay included in the rotation. And as the rotation getting longer, decreasing the seed bank of really pigweed number one in my area by far, lamb's quarter number two of the weeds that are the real problem. Cover crops is part of the issue, and we've had the whole zone till session here looking at this, but again, increasingly being looked at as a mechanism to control the weeds. And once again, there's Teasdale. I don't know how you guys got so many slides in this presentation. You must be taking most of the data. but really looking at, they've done an excellent job dissecting that part of, you know, yes, there's physical suppression of the weeds. Yes, there's also allele chemical suppression of the weeds and the real power of these surface residues of these cover crops to control weeds. Okay, simple-minded basic agronomic research. So this is my slide. But really just the very simple things that have to be rethought in the organic context. So this is the standard recommended planting rate here in North Carolina. And you know, the growers, when they go organic, intuitively say, I want to put more seed out there than that. Who wouldn't do that? But the growers in our area, when they did that, they went up to 125,000, 150,000 plants per acre, and that seemed like a reasonable amount. But really, we forget, you know, maybe 60, 70 years ago, we were planting up there even a lot higher. Soybeans do not lodge until you get to really substantial populations. And as far as weed management tactics go, throwing more seed out there, at least in the case of soybean, is a very cheap alternative. And so we can see excellent, you can see the amount of the differential in weed control just from a simple agronomic trait like that is really tremendous. Cultivar selection, you know, there's not actually a lot of literature on this. I don't know if George Place is here. George Place worked on his PhD doing a lot of this work looking at genotypic variation, whether we could actually breed for competitive ability against weeds. But here's a screening of 45 genotypes looking at the just this very simple trait of how much ground cover can you establish early on in the cropping season and how is that related to weed suppression. And actually we have a nice relationship here. I mean, R square of 0.28 may seem like small, but again, as those little bitty hammers, switching cultivar is a very easy thing to do, and from an economic point of view, it's the same. And we can have another little effect that we're going to add into our weed control model there. And then the final big hammer here that we come up, mechanical weed control. And the growers are spending a tremendous amount of effort on mechanical weed control. This slide actually got donated. This is what Carol Johnson in Georgia developed as his weed control program that he was recommending for peanuts. And it was interesting as he presented that to the whole group on a conference call. He said, yeah, that's about what we're seeing in the other crops as well. It's really the same in corn and soybean. The one outlier is probably, as we get up into the Beltsville, it sounds like they cultivate less of there on the eastern shore of Maryland. And then there, they look more similar to what it sounds like is going on in the Midwest, where a couple of rotary hoe passes or harrow passes and a couple of between row cultivations. But we have such a long season. I assume that's the case, that our growers are really cultivating a whole lot. So he's recommended at least five times, and I see growers, they're doing four to five times with a tine weeder. Then they're coming in two to three times with a between row cultivator. So just a tremendous number of passes across the field to control weeds. So while mechanical control is a big hammer, it cannot be the only thing, and really I can't emphasize that enough. Those other components have got to be a big part of this. Here's a nice data set. I'm not sure that I've seen this anywhere else in the literature, but the effectiveness of mechanical control is density dependent. And so a lot of these weeding mechanisms, if you get too many weed seeds out there, it actually gets harder and harder to control them with a blind cultivator. And so this is a slide donated by Stephen Mirsky as part of his PhD research when he was at Penn State. Okay, another facet that we're rather infamous for in the Southeast is disease pressure. It's hot and humid. If you stand still in one place too long, you may mold yourself. And we have the breeding, from an organic point of view, breeding has not been able to answer all the, there's not historically been a lot of attention paid to organic production in these breeding communities. And so one of the things we're trying to address, we have a big grant right now at North Carolina where we're looking at addressing a lot of these issues for organic farmers. And Emily Cantonwine, a pathologist and Albert Colbreth, another pathologist both in Georgia, donated this slide here, looking at peanut breeding and just commenting on what's been going on in peanut breeding and how that is not meeting the needs of the organic farmers. And one of the biggest challenges they have is just getting a stand to establish itself. So peanuts always goes out with a treated seed. And they've had greater than 70% failure of stand emergence just because they don't have that seed treatment, and breeders have not been looking at resistance to seedling diseases. Now, there has been a lot of examination of resistance to foliar diseases, but that doesn't oftentimes correlate with resistance to seedling diseases. And so that's one of the things that Tom Islip at North Carolina State is looking to address now for looking at organic. He's trying to screen now, or doing a very wide screen for resistance to seedling diseases. You may have heard that it's also very warm and wet down there, which creates another, the soil fertility issues we have there are fairly distinct from other parts of the country. Very heavy levels of weathering, leaching. I can remember when I was studying soil science there a number of years ago, we said that it was really pretty much impossible on our very well aerated soils to get any accumulation of organic matter. I think that we're showing that's not true anymore, but that was the thinking. Legume cover crops, we have a lot of variation here because if you look at the number of species and the diversity that we can grow down there and the growing season which we have to grow them, I think that's quite distinct from the rest of the country as well. And we have an enormous animal industry in the southeast, and so that can be both an advantage to organic producers and sometimes a curse if we're over-reliant on it. Okay, again, here's another set of slides out of the Beltsville group. But very well documenting that we can, in fact, build organic nitrogen pools in the soil, and they're on a very well aerated soil, a lot of heat and humidity, but it is possible in these systems to build some level of organic matter and organic nitrogen in the soil. A lot of the researchers have been working on into various aspects of animal waste research. Some of the things they've been looking at, nutrient characterizations, looking at those ratios of nitrogen and phosphorus to micronutrients. Of course, one of the concerns with the reliance that the organic grain production we have right now on animal manures is that, we're going to apply according to nitrogen demands and then as a result build up phosphorus. We can build up zinc and copper coming out of the broiler litter that can really become a problem. And so very much paying attention to the long-term sustainability of trying to keep those nutrients balances in check so that we're not creating environmental problems. Increasingly, too, the big operations are processing their waste coming out of this. And so there's a lot of availability, and I know this is across the country because this is being moved everywhere. We have all of these different products to some level of processing that is affecting their plant availability. And we have a number of the researchers have been looking at that. And then, of course, just sort of all the nuance of management alternatives for how you manage that animal waste. Here's a slide. Carl Crozier from NC State is here. Donated in, and processing of the manure sources or the processed feather meal, it can have very surprising effects on plant availability. So he's shown that actually pelletizing the chicken manure makes it less available than the raw chicken manure would have been in the first place, which was surprising. Again, the diversity of the cover crops that we can grow out there are really amazing. And then we've had a lot of researchers looking at just the issues that we can do with the species and variety selection, since there is so much variety out there, the timing of the seeding and kill, termination method. And then here's a little slice from Julie Grossman's lab, where she's been doing some excellent work on looking at rhizobia bacteria diversity and looking at whether we can affect that to affect more nitrogen fixation in these systems. Conclusion, major challenges we have, certainly weeds, diseases, and then preventing phosphorus and micronutrient overload, ranked right up there. Here's something I think that's quite distinct from what I've heard from other speakers in some other regions, is that, both in replicated trials, whether it's coming out of the long-term systems trial at Beltsville, or the split operations that are reporting back to us when they have both organic production and conventional production on the same farm, is we do have a yield reduction in these systems. So, I'm guessing that yield reduction's in the 20 to 30% range, across many of these farms. So we are not able to grow them at the same yield. Nonetheless, organic grains are proving more profitable and are continuing to expand at a very rapid rate throughout the region. So how am I on time? Have time for questions? All right.
We've got about 5 minutes for questions. Feel free.
I got a question on the chick manure. Do you know what it is in the pelletizing that makes it less available, nitrogen less available?
No.
It's lignin sulfonate that goes in there, and it's been banned in Japan for years. You couldn't use it here in the U.S.
Okay.
It's a binding agent. I'm wondering if that has something to do with it.
Oh, okay. Interesting. You know, and it's the opposite for the feather meal, and of course they've purposely done that. The feather meal, they have actually increased the availability quite a bit with their, but it's been the opposite on the pelleting of the manure. I wasn't aware of that lignin sulfate. Very interesting.
Yeah, they do use an agent. I think it's lignin sulfate.
Chris, on your soybeans, what was the rust spacing on those?
Yeah, we do 30 inches on everything for our research program, and that's about the average. I have a few guys out there at 36 or 38, and then I have one guy in at 20 inches, but probably the bulk of them are at 30, and so that's what we run our program off of. Yeah. It's interesting. I've always been fascinated by this. When they first convert, the first idea that an organic grower often has is that I'm going to drill the soybeans in a clean till situation. And then year two, they're back out there on a row spacing. You know, they just, that canopy closure does not seem to compensate for the fact that I can't get a piece of steel in there.
Yeah. Chris, can you talk a little bit about marketing structure in the Southeast and demand?
That's a good question, and I think that's very distinct from what I hear about the Midwest. For the most part, already in the Southeast, we've moved away, more and more of it has moved away from an elevator model. So farmers are trucking directly to the buyer in most of the case, and we do not have that many elevators, even in conventional at this point. On organic, we have zero elevators. So it is going directly to the buyers in that case. So, and you know, in North Carolina, we have two organic wheat mills now. We have one organic soybean crusher. We have a large organic egg layer operation that is buying in feed wheat and feed corn. So, and the trucker, I mean, and at this point, too, all the growers, they're not even contracting out their own trucking anymore. Most of them have a small fleet of tractor trailers, and they're moving it all around themselves. So.
So I was just curious, with your new project on grain breeding, how's that sort of spinning on the research that you're reporting here?
Oh, it's a great question. So, you know, and gave the example of peanut, but In our breeding work, we worked with growers trying to identify in each of these major crops, what is the public breeding sector not already doing? And they are already doing a lot. I mean, if you look at public breeding at this point, they are trying to breed for disease resistance they're trying to breed for a number of things that is very interesting to organic. There's just a couple of components that are different about organic. Did I see Major Goodman? Major Goodman's in the background. So he's the corn breeder working on this project. So one of the things he identified there very early on is their cross-contamination with GMO corn is increasingly becoming an issue. So we have more buyers that are starting to test, and it's become very cheap to test for GMO contamination. So our growers were planting later and later to try to avoid that issue. Major is working on putting a crossing barrier in there that will prevent GMO contamination of the corn. So that, you know, we had a very separate story for each of the commodities to what growers identified as a big issue. You know, in peanut, the breeding was already going on for the foliar disease resistance, but the seedling disease resistance wasn't there. In soybean, we've been looking at competitive ability that's going on there. In wheat, we have both competitive ability with ryegrass being looked at. Also, though, we have tying in with hard wheats because, like Heather noticed, there's a lot of demand from artisanal bakeries. In the Southeast, we've only grown soft wheats historically, but now there's a lot of demand for a locally grown bread, and we have to do that by having a hard wheat that's adapted to the Southeast humidity. So there's a really very different story depending on the commodity. It's a great question. You know, it's interesting that we see almost no perennial pressure on any of the organic farms we work on. And I think it's that cultivation routine that I've talked about there. It just selects against them immediately, and they just don't show up. Now, if we're going to go back towards a roll-killed system, I think a long-term question emerges. Are you going to start to see the perennials reemerging? So, are you shoving me off now?
I am.
I was just getting into this question session. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.